This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for July 2008. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature a few poems and articles in the upcoming issue.
This month, we're going to hear a poem by the always unpredictable Dean Young.
I don't know what I'm talking about either.
A poem from Catherine Starbuck.
I do my best to keep pointlessness at bay.
And we're also going to call David Orr to talk about his piece, The Politics of Poetry.
The Academy tends to have a certain political perspective, and so poets tend to follow suit.
But first, let's talk about a couple other things in the issue, which is a big double issue for both July and August. In fact, it's one of the biggest issues we've ever done.
Yeah, I think it is the biggest since I've been here. We call it our summer break issue. I'm not sure why we call it that, because it's hardly a break for the editors. It turns out to be much more work than the others. But it allows us to sort of expand the contents and include some things that we wouldn't have in the other issues.
Yeah, we kind of try to dream up stuff that might surprise people and please them over the summer months. And we have some special features and illustrations and even a crossword puzzle for the summer.
We've got poets remembering poets that they've known. A very funny piece, Fanny Howe remembering Edward Dahlberg, and she said Dahlberg actually chases her out of the apartment, doesn't she?
She says he chased me around his apartment on Rivington Street with his pants down, having locked the door from the inside, and I had to leap out a window to get away from him. There's some must reading.
Yeah, we've got a great reminiscence of the poet Hayden Carruth by W.S. DiPiero. He looks at Hayden Carruth over several different periods in his life, and Carruth actually was the editor of Poetry Magazine for a time. I think he was a pretty controversial editor and got the boot, but a powerful figure in poetry for years.
There are quite a few of these little features. I think you'll be happy to see them, some memorable stories there. And we also have a couple special portfolios, and one of them is a portfolio of previously unpublished work by the Berkeley Renaissance poet Jack Spicer.
Now, Jack Spicer seems to be enjoying a renaissance himself. He's a compelling figure for a lot of younger poets these days, I think. He was a translator, and it's hard to pin Jack Spicer down. He did so many different things.
Yeah, he had this great idea that the poet is a kind of radio who collected transmissions from the invisible world. But he also helped start the famous Six Gallery out in California, which is where Allen Ginsberg read Howl and supposedly launched the Beat movement. But our predecessors at Poetry rejected Spicer's work in the past, although
right,
he got three reviews in our pages. So right. We've corrected that oversight by publishing some poems that will be in the forthcoming collected poems edited by Peter Gizzi.
There's also a substantial essay by Vivian Gornick, who takes three books about the friendships of poets and the relationships that writers have and weaves that together with the memory of a friendship she had with a woman, an intellectual friendship. And she talks about its demise and then talks about the demise of the friendships of the poets in these books. And it is a very compelling and sad, in the end, memoir review.
But it also covers a lot of territory in the geography of poetry, going from Coleridge all the way up to the New York School poets. And she even refers to Frank O'Hara as the Coleridge of his set.
Yeah, it's my favorite kind of writing about poetry often is when people are able to weave critical writing in with personal writing, make a balance out of that, fuse it together somehow.
Yeah, she takes her reading to heart, which is what a good reader does.
Yeah. Let's look at a few of the poems in the issue. Don, before we hear from Dean Young and Catherine Starbuck, is there another poem that you wanted to talk about?
Well, we've published Wendy Vitalock a few times, and she keeps surprising us. Here is a poem by her called My Moses. She lives out in the mountains out west. Big Jack and his walking stick live on the ridge. Navajo orphan kids dance for him. Bobcat urines in the weeds. The shotgun barrel's up his sleeve. A Persian coin is on the wind. The Chinese mountains smell the moon and arch their backs. I tell him, Jack, there's times I wish I was living in canvas France, the old west, a picture book, the sea of tranquility, or even in the den near the hot spring. He says, kid, to hell with phantom limbs. Spring is a verb. A wish is a wash. A walking stick is a goddamn wing.
Yeah, it sort of mocks that desire to escape your circumstances because the escapes are so outlandish here. And I like it that his reproach is not sort of the familiar approach that you would expect of, you know, write about what you know, or, you know, be happy with your circumstances, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But it's these things: a wish is a wash, spring is a verb, a walking stick is a goddamn wing. These crazy things.
And the irritation in the poem. A lot of poems in their trajectory toward the lyrical forget that things can be very and people can be very irritated and irritating.
A very different poem in the issue is by David Beispiel, called A Theory of Hats. David lives out in the Northwest, lives in Portland. He has rejuvenated the magazine Poetry Northwest and turned that into a must-read recently. It had languished for years unedited, and he found backers for it and picked it back up. The Theory of Hats is it's a bit tougher to hear on a first reading than the one we just read from Wendy Vitalock. You have to sort of let go of this poem, because what it does is, it's called The Theory of Hats, and it introduces an outlandish theory that you can hardly follow for the first few lines, and maybe the first 15 lines, actually. And then the poem makes an abrupt transition midway through, and it becomes quite clear. And the poem is sort of a juxtaposition of a scene with this elaborate theory. And I think the meaning of the poem inheres in the way that you relate those two things together. The Theory of Hats. It is hard even to admit this theory of hats, that to wear the faithless one brimmed tightly over the eyes, the featherless and discreet one, a hat with a secret code that says to spoil the child is to fatten the serpent. To wear that hat, imperfectly as a crow's crown, against the sun is to bear the ruins of the unborn into our hearts. He, shouting at the brunt of trees. She, shifting like a seer to restore them. It is hard to know happiness with a hat like that, or to forget the pangs sung with such burly impatience, or to heal the blurred things and soft hurts. Even the blind self becomes a dervish, what with the torsion and the far-off vita nuova like a new virus or virtuoso, what with the tussles and old pure-lit suppressions. Then to be surprised by joy, like the last rain of summer, the big, spiraling, wounded animal of rain with no place to turn, drumming the brown grass, rain falling without meaning but perfectly faithful, into the petals of wind and the unopened roots, such tenderness looked to, like love, but unquestioned. Then some afternoon, with the sky lifting off again, she will come to sit on the porch like a dark sparrow and let the sun creep slowly onto her hair and grow old and wonder about the balance of things. And he beside her, sitting, too, distracted in the sun for hours, but all the same, both of them, at last, so much warmer.
Well, I don't really know what the theory of hats is.
There is no theory here, mm-hmm. And it's a theory.
Only
of,
practice.
Well, exactly. That's right. That's right. The practice is this couple growing old together and recognizing the changes each other and feeling so much warmer.
Yeah, and enlightened it's, by and yet other. It's the surroundings that are perfectly faithful in a way. It all fits together. The sort of balance of the weather that can be off balance or throw you off balance is sort of an equilibrium, but it reminds you that it's not stasis, that equilibrium consists of things being kind of out of kilter and out of balance, and then they sort of work together to create a larger kind of entity.
Yeah.
And that's what this couple would be.
Yeah, I find it a very moving poem, even though you can't quite explain the totality of it. You know, it leaves you flummoxed slightly,
yeah.
And yet somehow stirred.
Well, Catherine Starbuck is a poet who lives in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and she's the widow of the poet George Starbuck, who's one of my old teachers and mentors. Her poem's about trout fishing, and we asked her if she was a serious fisherwoman.
No, I've never gone trout fishing.
Fair enough.
So it didn't really happen? The poem is a fiction?
Well, it's not complete fiction. I lived in New Hampshire and Boston for 20 years, and I used to go to the White Mountains and sit in the middle of trout streams and tickle trout with my hands.
That's a ticklish image right there. Here's Catherine Starbuck reading her short poem, Trout.
I do my best to keep pointlessness at bay, but here, wet above my knees, I let it fly. Here, hot and cold, fingers thick with thinking, I try to tie the fly and look for the net, loosening the philosophical knot of why I came here today, not yet knowing whether I'll free or fry the rainbows and browns once they're mine.
I think she said when she sent this poem in that there was a little bit of reaction in it against Bishop, against the fish in Elizabeth.
Oh, really?
Bishop. Yeah.
Huh. You mean in the fish where she says,
yeah.
And then everything was rainbow, rainbow, rainbow,
right,
and
exactly.
I let the fish go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So here, I guess Catherine Starbuck just might fry up that fish.
Right, right. Well, the Bishop poem, you know, goes on forever. She holds that fish right. out of the water for, you know, what, 3 pages or whatever, however long that poem
yeah.
is, looking at it. The poor thing just, you know, gasping
yeah, with
for
his
air.
Eyes glazing
That's
over.
Right.
You know, that I love that. I love Bishop's poem, and I wouldn't have thought I would like a poem that's written kind of in opposition to it, but this is beautifully in opposition to it. The funny thing that my own eye takes in here is just how curtailed these lines are on the page. It really is anti-Bishop in that sense. It looks like the first few words of each of Bishop's lines in that poem.
Yeah.
But as you can hear when she reads it, she's got her own rhythm for it. She does, you know, the poem takes off. It isn't really dependent on the Bishop poem in the end.
Yeah, I love the sounds there that she ends with. I'll
free or fry the rainbows and browns once they're mine.
I suppose, you know, we feel obliged when it comes to nature to say that we should be respectful and that these things belong to the earth and we should treat them nicely. And I like the plain humanity of somebody who's contemplating that power in her own hands.
Yeah, it's also nice that, you know, you think you're going to get a Zen-like moment here. I do my best to keep pointlessness at bay. And then, you know, that you would expect the poet to then find value in that pointlessness and have a little epiphany. And actually, it's, you know, am I going to have my epiphany or am I going to eat it? Am I going to, you know,
I wonder if we can have your epiphany and eat it too.
Right, yeah.
The pointlessness is not just talking in her case. I don't think it's essential to the poem to know that Catherine Starbuck was married to a very well-known poet. And while George Starbuck was alive, Catherine never wrote poems and did not conceive of herself as a person who could write poems.
Because that's decades, right?
I mean, it's, many, many yeah. years. And he won awards. And, you know, after he died, I think she did have to do her best to keep pointlessness at bay. And then very spontaneously and unexpectedly, she began to write poems. I don't know that she had any real guidance from Starbuck or his spirit in this regard. And she had to invent herself as a poet.
Yeah,
which must have been a courageous thing
yeah.
to do.
And she just published her first book, you know, late in her life.
Yeah, that book was called Grief Mania. And so when she does her best to keep pointlessness at bay and says so in the poem, I believe her. I have met her, and I'm trying to picture her fishing and tickling trout with her fingers. But I guess if anybody can, this poet can.
It's Catherine Starbuck.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Dean Young has appeared many times in Poetry Magazine. He teaches down at the University of Texas in Austin. He just took a job down there. And Don, I guess you describe his poetry maybe as madcap surrealism. I once thought of it as a kind of buoyant gravity or gravid buoyancy, however you want to, you know, however you want to arrange that.
I think his poems defy description. I will say this. Some of his recent poems came in. He types on an old manual typewriter, and the ribbon was fading and fading away, and you had to really stare at these things to read them. And then suddenly he came up with a brand new ribbon and in bold black typewriter print these poems.
You were bothered by it, yeah.
Yeah, I got so used to the old faded ribbon. So there's something madcap about that, I think, in this day and age.
So this poem is called Selected Recent and New Errors. And what is this poem about, do you think, Don?
I don't know. I can only imagine a guy typing his poems making mistakes recently and invariably, inexorably. So maybe it's got something to do with that.
Now here's what Dean himself had to say about it.
Yeah, what is it about? It's about 50 lines long, I think.
One thing to keep in mind about this poem, the Tony mentioned in the poem is the poet Tony Hoagland, who's a close friend of Dean Young's. Here's Dean Young reading Selected Recent and New Errors.
My books are full of mistakes, but not the ones Tony's always pointing out, as if correct spelling is what could stop the conveyor belt the new kid caught his arm in. 3 weeks on the job and he's already 600 legal pages. Lawyers haggling in an office with an ignored view of the river, pretending to be asleep, pretending to have insight into its own muddy self. You think that's a fucked up, drawn out metaphor? Try this. If you feel you're writhing like a worm in a bottle of tequila, you don't know it's the quickness of its death that reveals the quality of the product, its proof. I don't know what I'm talking about either. Do you think the dictionary ever says to itself, I've got these words that mean completely different things inside myself, and it's tearing me apart? My errors are even bigger than that. You start taking down the walls of your house. Sooner or later, it'll collapse, but not before you can walk around with your eyes closed, rolled backwards, and staring straight into the amygdala's meat locker, and your own damn self hanging there. Do that for a while, and it's easier to delight in snow that lasts about 20 minutes longer than a life held together by the twisted silver baling wire of deception and stealth. But I ain't confessing nothing. On mornings when I hope you forget my name, I walk through the high, wet weeds that don't have names either. I do not remember the word do. I do not remember what I told you with your ear in my teeth. Further and further into the weeds, we have absolutely no proof God isn't an insect rubbing her hind legs together to sing, or boring into us like a yellow jacket into a fallen, overripe pear, or an assassin bug squatting over us, shoving a proboscis right through our breastplate, then sipping. How wonderful our poisons don't kill her.
I love the way he can be funny in one line, serious in the next line, sometimes in the same line, you know.
Yeah, the conveyor belt. The new kid caught his arm and reminded me of that Frost poem, Out, Out, which is a not funny poem.
Right.
It's a great poem, but it isn't funny. And I think only Dean Young can see a horrible accident as being a kind of, you know, it's like the phantom limb pain. You know, he sort of reads all these errors into one big book.
Do you think the dictionary ever says to itself, I've got these words that mean completely different things inside myself, and it's tearing me apart? My errors are even bigger than that.
The dictionary's a book of errors. Nature's a book of errors. Everything we do can collapse around us. And he sees that all, but makes it sound like, you know, something that might happen after a few drinks.
Yeah. You know, writing a poem, I mean, any successful poem is in some way an ascent to your errors. I mean, the poem takes you in some direction that you couldn't have predicted. And when it first happens, it seems like an error. And I think what he points to in this poem is, I mean, he's pointing to a literal thing. You know, I know Tony Hoagland. One time, Tony Hoagland and Dean Young were in this office, and Tony started pointing out an error in one of my poems. So this must be something that he does periodically. In good spirits, but he's clearly, you know, very punctilious about that. And Dean is sort of all over the place. He sends in poems that are full of errors.
Yeah, we query them occasionally.
Right.
when he's feeling like it's a good thing to do, he'll set us straight.
Right.
But then he says, here, I ain't confessing nothing.
Right.
That's kind of the attitude you have to have.
But I think he's saying that there's, or implicit in this poem is that there can be a kind of grace in those errors, a grace in our worst mistakes.
Yeah, we have absolutely no proof of many things.
We have absolutely no proof God isn't an insect rubbing her hind legs together to sing.
We're in trouble, and we're so threatening that we're not even only threatening to ourselves, but we can even kill off the assassin bug. That's a neat trick
there. Kill off God. Although this is how wonderful our poisons don't kill her.
Always something to be thankful for.
Yeah. David Orr writes the column On Poetry for the New York Times, and he has written for Poetry Magazine for years. For the July-August issue, he wrote an article on the politics of poetry, and David joins us by phone from the beach in South Carolina. Hi, David.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. David, Barack Obama's soaring rhetoric has often been called poetic. Would you say this is good for poetry or bad for Obama?
That's a good question. You know,
I don't know. I guess a little bit of both. You know, it is. I guess it is good for poetry in the sense that it makes the idea of poetry one that's a little bit more acceptable in the public sphere. As to whether it's bad for Obama, well, I don't know about that. Probably so, unfortunately. I mean, yeah. You've probably noticed so far in the campaign, I mean, one of the themes that Clinton tried with Obama and that will probably be tried by McCain as well is the idea that speaking poetically is somehow equivalent to speaking emptily, to not really saying anything or just having, you know, high-flown language without anything behind it.
Well, now, tell us why you think something that's poetic has come to mean that.
You know, I think that sometimes it means that, and then other times it doesn't mean that. I guess, you know, and it's confused, too, because we confuse poetry with rhetoric, because they're closely related, and they're sometimes the same thing. And sometimes rhetoric is what we want. I mean, you think about Martin Luther King and all of the great speakers from America's past. And then, you know, other times rhetoric, again, is sort of used car salesman idea.
Right. You know, you say that the relationship between American poetry and American politics is confused and confusing. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
It's confused in the sense that the two things rely on each other in ways that are very complicated and that I have a lot of trouble following personally, and I suspect a lot of other writers do as well. And it's sort of confusing because then when people start talking about it, and especially when they start talking about political poetry, there's a disconnect between sort of what they're saying and what the actual effect of a lot of the writing that they're discussing has on readers.
Now, a lot of this probably involves some preaching to the converted.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So, as you know, quite a lot of things that go on in the poetry world involve preaching to the converted. And that's not necessarily such a bad thing. I mean, I don't mean to criticize that in the way that it often gets criticized. I mean, the poetry world is certainly no worse than a lot of other areas of American life in terms of having its own way of looking at things and not really liking to hear other ways. But I think, you know, when we're talking about political poetry, and you guys feel free to say if you have a different impression of it, you know, we're talking about the same kind of politics, and we're talking about the same kind of political issues, and we're talking about a lot of assumptions that all of us really already have. So where we have a break is between the idea of political poetry as being poetry about political subjects and political poetry as being poetry that's actually persuasive to somebody.
Do you have any idea why that is, that so many poets seem to have the same assumptions about politics? Because certainly you couldn't say that that's always been the case. If you look at the lists of modernists, you know, you could find tons of reactionary conservatives, and it doesn't seem to be the case now.
I'm really perplexed by it, and I feel like in some way maybe it isn't the case, and maybe there are people who have different takes on things, and we're just not hearing from them.
Hmm.
I mean, obviously, you know, part of it is just because poetry has become more professionalized and it's become more deeply involved in the academy, and these are things that everybody's been saying for years, and, you know, there are positives to that and there are negatives to it. But, you know, the academy tends to have a certain political perspective, and so poets maybe tend to follow suit. I really don't know. I mean, because you can't think of a reactionary American poet right now, at least I can't.
Right. Well, you can think, I mean, I know that Dana Joy is conservative. I wouldn't call him reactionary, but he's certainly conservative.
You know, that's actually a great case in point, because the fact that Dana Joy gets talked about as if he is an arch conservative kind of tells you exactly how limited the political vision of a lot of the poetry world is. And I don't mean that, again, as a criticism. I mean limited in just the sense of occupying a pretty narrow part of the spectrum of American politics, because obviously in America we have people who have politics that are far, far to the right of Dana Joya.
Oh, yeah,
unless I misunderstand, because I don't know Dana Joya, but having read some of his writing, I get the impression he's sort of a, you know, moderate Republican.
Maybe I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's right.
If that's our version of an arch conservative, you know, obviously we occupy a pretty liberal branch of the tree.
Yeah, where's our Ezra Pound?
I know. You can't even imagine somebody like that. Now, the closest we have is sort of a Mary Baraka on the far opposite end.
Yeah, that's true.
That's
yeah.
true. Well, now, you say that the path to richer political poetry is still open. What would this path be? What's it look like?
You know, it's not for me to say. It's for other writers to say. But one thing in sort of thinking about some of the issues that seem to come up when we talk about political poetry, it seems that what we're kind of missing sometimes is a poetry that feels comfortable on a public stage politically. I talk a little bit about some of the political poetry that gets written right now, some of which is often very beautiful, but it doesn't really function fiction is public speech in a way. And I think that that's something that, you know, maybe we'll see change if some of our writers get more comfortable thinking about themselves as political actors. I mean, this is the one thing about politics, is that if you want to engage in politics, you have to be willing to be criticized politically as a public speaker. And I think a lot of poets don't want that. And I can understand, because I wouldn't want it either.
Right.
But, you know, if you want your poems to have that political force, you have to open yourself up to the criticism.
So you think people are avoiding this? We have a debate right now on our blog, Harriet, and someone's pointing out over there that there are more good love poems than good war poems. I mean, first of all, do you think that's true?
Oh, I'll have to pass. I'm have to think about it. It's very difficult, though. And actually, it's funny because one thing that I'm sure you guys noticed before, too, is that, you know, there's a tendency when talking about political poetry to say, you know, well, all poetry is political and so on and so forth, which is, you know, one of those statements which you kind of see what people mean when they say it. But at the same time, I hate to use the strong phrase here, but it's nonsense.
Right, you know, it's vapid, yeah.
Bit of poetry is political, then the political is reduced to basically nothing. I mean, it is a descriptive category, and we do mean certain things by it, just like, you know, not every poem is a love poem, and not every poem is a poem about war. But you will see people try to make the case that, you know, a certain kind of love poem is actually a political poem, and I could see how that might be true in certain instances, and sometimes it is true, but generally speaking, it's not.
And you do a great job in your essay about showing how some poems that clearly weren't meant to be political become political, like Kay Ryan's poem, Home to Roost.
When I wrote it, I was kicking myself for a number of choices that I'd made. But when I went to send it to an editor in New York, it was at the time of 9/11, and it was on her desk at that time, and it suddenly sounded exactly as though I was commenting on that event as it was happening. And I had to call her and ask for the poem back. It was so cruel, although now I think it would have had a certain element of truth, but it would have been a very inappropriate truth for that time. Home to Roost. The chickens are circling and blotting out the day. The sun is bright, but the chickens are in the way. Yes, the sky is dark with chickens, dense with them. They turn, and then they turn again. These are the chickens you let loose, one at a time, and small, various breeds. Now they have come home to roost, all the same kind, at the same speed.
Obviously, Kay Ryan, you know, writing a poem before a political event that would later sort of affect the readings of her poem, couldn't have been thinking about things in the way that they would later be seen. And obviously also her poem, I should say, is not necessarily, I mean, you can just read it as a poem, and it's extremely effective, and it's a great poem. But it is, I think, pretty hard to read it just as a poem, given the fact that the central metaphor for that poem, you know, things coming home to roost, has been used so often after September 11th, you know, for various reasons by people. You know, most recently, I guess, by Jeremiah Wright in the YouTube videos that were going around everywhere.
Right, right.
Okay, David. So, if Obama wins, what poet reads at his inauguration? And if McCain wins, you think Robert Pinsky will read at his?
Boy, I don't know. I think it's a pretty hard question. You know, I actually think that both of them, and this is the really interesting thing, I think both of them are the kind of candidates who actually would have a preference, which is something that I don't know that we've seen for a long time. You know, George W. Bush, I don't think he had anybody read at his inauguration, did he? I'm pretty sure he did. And then Clinton, I guess, had Maya Angelou and then had
Miller Williams.
Oh, right, exactly, Miller Williams. Mm-hmm. Both of those choices were obviously heavily influenced by geography and then some political commitments on Bill Clinton's part. I think Obama and McCain might both be the kind of guys who really might have a contemporary poet that they like. At least I'd like to think so.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, David. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks, Don.
Thanks.
You can read David Orr's article, The Politics of Poetry, and everything else you've heard on this program online at poetrymagazine.org and in the July-August issue of Poetry Magazine.
It's a double issue, so tune in next month to hear a performance of Killing Him, a radio play that appeared in the issue by the great Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is produced by Curtis Fox and Ed Herman. The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.